Rapping on the wars we fight, rapping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. I read about some squirrely guy that claims that he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life, our fighting men have fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country horse, you're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down a way of life, or fighting in it, fought and died to keep. If you don't love it, leave it. Let the song that I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com, where lots more news and views for our people. And those, of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia and New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Well, oh, yes, I was in my, I won't say my favorite bank, but in the bank this afternoon, one of the banks I go to. This is the TD, or Toronto Dominion Bank, and just seems to be non-stop propaganda, you know, above the teller's counters up on the wall. There are these TV screens, and they flash, oh, timely information like the five-day forecast for this area and other bits and pieces and stuff about the bank and some of its products. All that's all right. But today I noticed hashtag buy week. BI-week. And I wondered what that was. Well, I kind of knew. That's bisexual week. Is over, but and then they introduced I think it was a picture of somebody, let's just call her Mary, and then it goes on to say that Mary is bi and proud. Oh, good for Mary. And then the next thing was hashtag 52 weeks of pride. Now, that's not pride in the bank's products or something that might be defensible, or pride in Canada or what, but it's one of these hijacked words or terms that have been hijacked, and that is gay pride. So 52 weeks of the year, the bank is proud of the fact that proud of the way some people perform sex. To be crude, although not all inclusive, pride in what orifice one uses. Well, now, quite frankly, this is disgusting. And, you know, this propaganda is nonstop. Gay Pride Week was at the end of June. Well, okay. We had propaganda before that. But you know, we're now almost at the end of September, and still the propaganda continues. We had propaganda for various gay couples. Two middle-aged white men, one arm around another in a hammock, and another part of the pride. Two Negress lesbians, one with, you know, one of these de rigueur buzz haircuts. And about a week or two ago when I was in there, repeated message said that the bank supported over 100 LGBT, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and very, in other ways, mixed up group committees or groups, plus 63 different pride parades. By support, I mean, I suspect they mean financial. Now, I'm a shareholder as well as a customer. That means some of my money going to something I totally disapprove of. And this is the sort of mainstream establishment propaganda being unleashed on us 24/7. And that's why I warn people. That I believe in the free enterprise system, but I am not an uncritical supporter of businesses, because I think very often the business world, especially big businesses, the multinational corporations, are very much not on our side. Now, what is the purpose of this repeated propaganda for a group of people that constitute about 1% of the population? Are they that vital to the bank's prosperity that they must be constantly sucked up to, made much of, celebrated? I'm going to be watching very closely to see if there's any celebration of Christian, of Christmas, or any recognition of normal families. They too have a right to pride. Anyway, got kind of bad news today. I got the Knights party newsletter from Pastor Tom Robb, and they had a very good Leadership and Family Congress on the Labor Day weekend. Now that's in the good news category, but in the somewhat bad news category, Pastor Tom Robb's Knights Party, like many other patriotic and nationalist groups, has been targeted again by one of the big multinational corporations. And this is what he reports in his September newsletter. 2 weeks ago, we were informed that the merchant account with our credit processor had been canceled. Many other white patriotic groups have also had their merchant accounts canceled too. The allegations have been that these groups, including ours, promote hate and it is in violation of merchant terms. Now, of course, that is an extremely loosey-goosey, vague term and virtually unprovable. Well, what is promoting hate? Opposition to certain people, opposition to the New World Order, opposition to being replaced on the by genocidal immigration policies. Is that hate? Anyway, Pastor Rob goes on to say, of course, the Knights Knights Party does not promote hate. We advocate for a white and Christian America, based on the foundation of this country. Some people call this hate, but it is not. We love our people and want a future for them. That is love. However, but you know, Right after Charlottesville, all sorts of nationalist, white pride, and other groups were targeted. Some lost their domain name, as happened with the Daily Stormer and Stormfront. Many lost their ability to process credit cards. Now this is a conspiracy of political persecution coming from the very top. And I want to say, and I don't like to make idle threats or to wave my skinny arms and say we're going to get you. I don't mean to say it in this spirit, but I do say this: as power shifts, and shift it will, and should we gain power or gain more power than we have now, we will remember the corporate thugs, the censors, who did this to us. And there are, or there ought to be, anti-discrimination laws. Can you imagine if they pulled the plug on, what's that group we were just talking about? Gay groups, or LGBTQ XYZ groups. Well, hell to pay. Anyway, Pastor Tom Robb continues. However, this is only a temporary blow. We know that you will come together and help us rise above this setback. What this means: we are unable to process debit or credit cards at this time. This is bad because it means that we are unable to accept credit or debit cards on our online store, and we cannot process automatic donations each month. And then he goes on to suggest that we supporters will have to send in checks or money orders or find other ways to make their contributions. And he goes on to say, we are working to fix this. However, until we do, please send your monthly donation in via a check or money order. And I'll give you the address. It's the American Heritage Committee, box 2222, so 3-4 twos. So American Heritage Committee, box 2222, Harrison, Arkansas, that's AR, 72602. So that's P.O. Box 2222, Harrison, Arkansas, AR, 72602. As I say, bad news in some ways, but this is the sort of persecution that I think we have come to expect. And I think we must be clear and make it clear to these censorship thugs in high financial places that they will not be forgotten. We're not a vengeful people, but we're not a stupid people. And the time will come when we will remember our enemies as well as our friends. And they have, by their own volition, on their own, decided to classify themselves among our enemies. Enemies of free thought, enemies of free speech, and we have to assume they are quite happy with an order which will replace the white people of North America with a third world majority. Did this suddenly happen? Well, no. I'm sure that right after Charlottesville, a panicked establishment, or panicked New World Order establishment, the cultural Marxists, swung into action, and directions, requests, orders, characterize it as you will, went out to big corporations. I'm sure these groups like the Knights Party had been targeted long ago by the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Anti-Defamation League, who were probably just waiting for the right moment to swing into action, as happened after Dylann Roof shot those nine Negroes at a Baptist church at a Bible studies session. those who hated the Confederate flag swung into action. Now, what the Confederate flag had to do with Dylann Roof, he didn't do those killings in the name of the Confederate flag. He said he was trying to, he was actually fighting black crime. Or he became aware of black crime and thought that was a big problem. Well, the fact is, it is a big problem. Almost immediately, there was almost as if on cue, cities, counties, the state of South Carolina wanted to take down the Confederate flag or Confederate monuments. This has been long planned, waiting only for the right opportunity. In politics, it's said that timing is everything. Now, here was the quotation I was struggling to find last night, so I gave you kind of the executive summary of it. This is from Rabbi Abaron Haviv at the World Jewish Congress Summit in 2011. The homogeneity of European nations is fundamentally against the interests of the Jewish people. We are at a critical turning point in history. The West is becoming more and more racially diverse, and soon the white race will be forced into submission. The future of the West is that of an ethnically diverse melting pot, where the evil divisions of race and white supremacy no longer reign. This is all thanks to the tremendous power of our social movements and institutions. This great change will be catalyzed by Muslim settlement. From the land of Israel, Jews will forever be a light unto the new mono-racial world as guaranteed by God. Now, and the way they do it, of course, is capital G hyphen D. They never spell out God's name. I have some trouble understanding what he means by the land of Israel. From the land of Israel, Jews will forever be a light unto the new monoracial world. I guess monoracial in the sense of mongrel. There won't be races, at least not in Europe. Listen to what he applauds. The homogeneity of European nations is fundamentally against the interests of Jewish people. Is it any wonder that Jews were behind, the Jewish lobby groups were behind the changes in the immigration laws in the United States, Canada, and Australia, all in 1965, or in the case of Australia, 1966, to get rid of laws that essentially guaranteed majority European immigration. So, okay, 50-some years have gone by since that cursed year of 1965, and we now have the United States only 61% white, where it was 90% white in 1961. Canada, 78% white, where it was 96-97% in 1961. And the minority, the only minority back then of any consequence, were the Indian or the Native people. And this is the horror that the lobbying, the open doors immigration movement pushed by the Zionist lobbies in Europe and in Australia and North America. The West is becoming more and more racially diverse, and soon the white race will be forced into submission. The future of the West is that of an ethnically diverse melting pot, where the evil divisions of race and white supremacy no longer reign. Well, I don't know what the divisions of white supremacy, it hardly even makes any sense. But it's quite clear that what they want is a completely overwhelmed white race, and the agents of this will be the Muslims. It'll be catalyzed into a Muslim settlement, and you know, you might wonder on the surface how Muslims who are militant, or I'm sure many of them who are militant, how that advances their agenda, whereas many whites are pro-Jewish. I think that's foolish, but they are. Many whites are pro-Jewish and quite favorable to Israel, quite hostile to to Islam. How does this help them? I'm not sure. I know, unless they believe that somehow that the Muslims are ineffectual and will not be able to really accomplish much, that they cannot really organize. Now I'm only speculating what they believe. However, this is the nightmare scenario that they have in mind for us. Anyway, I'd like to also look at a kind of an extended report or essay. This is the second time I will have referred to it or read it, but this will be the first time you've heard it, for a kind of complicated reason, for a technical reason that I cannot fully explain. I read this on my show last week, only to find that the show could not be saved. Anyway, that's one of the problems with our electronic media. I love the internet, but it doesn't always necessarily work out the way we'd like. Anyway, this is about one branch of Christianity and some very hopeful observations. Orthodox nationalism, a basis in scripture and sacred tradition. Now, it's often argued that Christianity is a universal religion and therefore is not helpful in preserving one's race, in that Christianity teaches universalism, it's for everybody. Well, that's certainly one interpretation. Loving one's nation and family has been an integral part of the Orthodox Church since the earliest days of the faith. Now, this is what's called the Greek, Russian, and various other smaller Slavic groups, Serbian, Romanian Orthodox. While all Orthodox Christians have a bond through Christ and are brothers and sisters in the spiritual sense, Orthodoxy has always understood the role of the nation and identity as part of the Church and the everyday lives of believers. It is not a paradox to believe that the only true homeland for Christians would be the New Jerusalem and the Second Coming, while also having a love and dedication to the homeland and ethnic group to whom God made you a child. The Russian Orthodox Church's Declaration on Church and Nation reaffirmed to Orthodox believers in the modern era that we have a moral obligation to care for our extended family, our folk, our race, or our nation. That's a very important point. The Declaration stated, quote, that the Church unites in herself the universal with the national. Orthodox Christians, aware of being citizens of the heavenly homeland, should not forget about their earthly homeland. Christian patriotism may be expressed at the same time with regard to a nation as an ethnic community and as a community of its citizens. The Orthodox Christian is called to love his fatherland, which has a territorial dimension, and his brothers by blood who live everywhere in the world. This love is one of the ways of fulfilling God's commandment of love to one's neighbor, which includes love to one's family, fellow tribesmen, and fellow citizens. Thus, no matter what the heresy of Ameridoxy is, and that's the Americanization, or you might almost call the Judaization of much of present mainstream Christianity. So no matter what the heresy of Ameridoxy tells us, it is not just an option for Orthodox Christians to stand for their people and their nation. It's a sacred duty. While the misguided priests and bishops of Ameridoxy try to persecute those who are following the tradition and Orthodoxy as practiced everywhere else in the world, We must remember the wisdom of St. John Chrysostom, that we must, quote, be aware not to be corrupted from love of the heretics. For this reason, do not accept any false belief in the name of love. In other words, you may love somebody, that doesn't mean you have to accept nonsense. The importance of identity and following tradition cannot be compromised simply to allow us to get along with those falling into the depths of heresy. The Orthodox world is standing on the firm foundation of tradition, while the American Church is falling quickly into the pit of modernity. And as Orthodox Christians in America, we must stand with the Church and the truth, not with those who have fallen away from tradition. Patriarch Kirill and the bishops of the Russian Orthodox Church reaffirmed something that the Church has known since its beginning. While we are one holy Catholic and apostolic Church, we do not lose our identity when we become Christians. So you are not to use a term favored by our trust fund kid in Canada, Justin Trudeau. We are not citizens of the world. Christians still have a responsibility to our immediate family and our extended family. Our immediate family, of course, are your blood relatives. Your extended family are your race, your people. Over those on the other side of the world. Scripture itself tells us in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 8, but if any provide not for his own, and especially for those of his house, he hath denied the faith, and is worse than an infidel. As Christians, we have a duty to love, pray for, and care for the entire world, as Christ himself did, but one's responsibility starts at home, with your own family, your own people, and your own nation. How hypocritical is it to say that you love your family and your nation if you do nothing to care for them and provide a stable and safe future for your own children? While white children in Appalachia go hungry at night, violent crime plagues the broken neighborhoods and schools of America's streets, and the elderly go without medicine in lonely nursing homes, how can we justify abandoning those in need of care, love, and ministry who are in our own backyards, and instead focus on people far away as the cries of those in need who are our neighbors go unheeded? Second Epistle of St. James, verses 15 and 16 of James 2, tells Christians, this is James, this is James, chapter 2, verses 15 and 16. Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes and daily food. If one of you says to them, go in peace, keep warm and well fed, but does nothing about their physical needs, what good is it? That is, of course, a good question. It is noble to desire to cure the problems of the entire world. One's responsibility starts at home with your own immediate family and your nation, which is defined by the Russian Orthodox Church as an ethnic community and aggregate citizens of a particular state. Relationships between church and nation should be viewed in the context of both meanings of this word. So an ethnic community and the aggregate citizens of a state. As a nation is a people tied together by the same blood, customs, language, and faith. The Russian Orthodox Church says that the unity of the people of God was secured by their ethnic and linguistic community and their rootedness in a particular land, their fatherland. To be an Orthodox nationalist, you can see the themes of faith, family, and folk going directly back to the Old Testament and forth to the modern era. God in the Old Testament instructed the Israelites to ensure that leadership for their nation would be drawn from their own folk. God in the Old Testament instructed the Israelites to ensure that leadership for their nation would be drawn from their own folk. not others. Look at what's happening to our Zionist-influenced politics today. The organic hierarchy of the nation created both a blood and faith tie between the people of, in the Old Testament, Israel, and their leadership, the king. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 15, to be sure to appoint over you a king that the Lord your God chooses. He must be from among your fellow Israelites. Do not place a foreigner over you, one who is not an Israelite. The people must have a tie to one another and to those who rule over them. The need for one to love the people and the nation of his or her birth is not only in Scripture. Spiritual leaders throughout church history have reaffirmed the importance of this. One such voice for tradition was Father Arseny, a priest who was imprisoned and tortured by the Russian communists, and he told his spiritual children, one has to know and love his fatherland. You have to love your own people. Well, this is Paul Froh. I'm going to continue that after a short musical break. And I'm going to pick up on some tunes the last couple of nights. I hope you enjoy this singer. This is Rebel Sun, and he's a very forceful singer and songwriter. Not all of his songs are necessarily for completely for family consumption. There's some fairly raw language in some of them, but not perhaps in this one. And this one is Mr. Confederate Man. Hope you like that. Rebel Sun, Mr. Confederate Man.
I was just a little boy in elementary school. English and math and science class, learning the golden rule. I learned how to add and how to subtract, how to multiply and divide. I learned about bugs and I learned about plants, and I learned how to read and write. But my most favorite class of all was my last class of the day, when my history teacher would tell us tales of old times long gone away. I was amazed at the way she knew all the people and their names and the places and the dates. That's when I first learned about General Lee and his 13 rebel states. One day she came to school with a big brown grocery bag. She opened it up, we all helped her hold up this great big egg-shaped flag. She said, class, now only a fool will tell you this flag is a symbol of hate. It represents the men who fought and died with pride for our Confederate states. Your assignment tonight, I want you to write, I want you to pretend that one of these brave men came back to life. Now what would you say to him? Well, the school bell rang and I thought, as the bus carried me across town, I got out my pencil and my notebook pad. This is what I wrote down. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. Next day in history class, I put my paper on the teacher's desk.
Then she called me up in front of everyone, because she said she liked mine the best. As I walked up to the head of the class, my teacher smiled and she nodded at me. Then I saw a tear roll down her cheek as I began to read. I read, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. Home reading through the news, and just the other day, when I ran across my old teacher's name, and I saw where she had passed away, with a bittersweet smile, I looked up at my wall, a wrinkled paper in an old wood frame, where underneath pencil words almost faded away, she had marked a great big red A. Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man. I wrote, Mr. Confederate Man, I'd like to shake your hand for giving your life for Dixieland, Mr. Confederate Man.
And that's Rebel Son with Mr. Confederate Man. Going to play another one by Rebel Son. Well, not that one. And we just played that one. And this one is Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee, Confederate Son.
Talking about Dixie and how old times used to be.
friend, sitting up drinking with Robert E. Lee.
Song, Sitting Up Drinking with Robert E. Lee, and this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of word of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I'm going to conclude our musical interlude tonight with a song by Heather Miles, country singer from California. Love Me a Little Bit Longer.
Don't wait up for me. We don't spend time together like we used to. And I'm tired of waking up in misery. When you love me, love me just a little bit longer. Now it might
that's Heather Miles, Love Me a Little Bit Longer. And this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada and the United States of America. I was reading quite a good essay from the Traditionalist Workers, or Traditional Workers Party, about at least the interpretation of Greek Orthodoxy, Greek and Russian Orthodoxy, of the importance of nation or race, and one's primary loyalty to that. Now, Christianity is sometimes being presented as a universalist religion, and this is what tends to make it weak in terms of protecting one's own race or people. And some may see this as perhaps an unfair knock on them, and others, like Nietzsche, felt it was quite valid. However, Orthodoxy says that your first loyalty, while all men may have a connection, that your first loyalty is to your nation, which is traditionally meant your ethnicity or your race. And this is not only a inclination that you have, this is an imperative. And he goes on to say, God in the Old Testament, to choose a leader from among the Old Testament, among the Israelites, from among your own people. And too often today, we see, under the pressure of multiculturalism, we see leaders who are not our own people leading us. For instance, the Lord Mayor of London is a Muslim. Outrageous. St. Jerome wrote in the 4th century that the biblical definition of brethren in both the Old and New Testament were not simply terms of civic unity, but a word to describe an ethnically based community and nation. In Against Helvetus, St. Jerome wrote, "How then, says Helvetus, do you make out that they were called the Lord's brethren, who were not his brethren? I will show how that is. Holy Scripture, there are four kinds of brethren, by nature, race, kindred, and love. As to race, all Jews," this is from the Old Testament, "are called brethren of one another. Moreover, they are called brethren by kindred, who are of one family." That is, which that's the Hebrew word which corresponds to the Latin paternitas. That is, you know, one father. Because from a single root, as a numerous progeny proceeds. The ancient church understood that the Old Testament call to loyalty to one's nation had not been done away with, as many modern liberals attempt to argue. Metropolitan Nestor Voronescu said, "Our Orthodox theology regards the national factor as belonging to the divine order and will. Orthodox faith has thus identified itself with our consciousness as a people. The church being above all, the church of the Romanian nation, of all generations, a church of a nation." This statement promotes the understanding that national and thus ethnic identity is part of the organic hierarchy of priorities for Orthodox Christians, and that supporting the nation is not just our will, but God's will, where the church and faith will always come first to an Orthodox Christian. But next comes one to tie to nation and one's people. So the importance of one's tie to and loyalty to your people. The Russian Orthodox Church declaration continues to tell believers that the patriotism of the Orthodox Christian should be active. It is manifested when he defends his fatherland against an enemy, works for the good of the motherland, cares for the good order of people's life through, among other things, participation in the affairs of government. The Christian is called to preserve and develop national culture and people's self-awareness. We are called not only to have an ethnic identity as a part of our Orthodox faith, but we are also encouraged to be politically and socially active to advance the cause of the church and of our national best interest. So patriotism is an imperative for the Christian, at least according to the teachings of the Orthodox churches of Russia, Greece, Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, etc. In modern politics, we see the intersection of blood and faith with the current crisis in the Ukraine. Patriarch Kirill publicly called for peace and said, "Our special prayers today is for the peoples of Russia and the Ukraine, so that peace should reign in the hearts and minds of our brothers and sisters by blood and by faith, so that the ties that we have lost and much-needed cooperation should be restored." The idea of shared ethnicity and shared faith being an important part of modern geopolitics and church affairs is regularly reaffirmed by leaders in Eastern Europe. But it's in the West where the heresy of universalism has taken hold. The work of Tsar Nicholas II, Saint John of Kronstadt, and countless other Russian saints of the 20th century are a firm example as to how church and nation can work in sympathy, in symphony, that is, together with one another. Saint Tsar Nicholas II, he of course was the murdered Tsar, murdered by Jewish communists in 1918 with the rest of the royal family. Tsar Nicholas II is the leader who produced tens of thousands of copies of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and had them distributed through the Orthodox Church to priests, bishops, and the citizenry. The Tsar had his secret police work to root out heretics, Bolsheviks, and other enemies of both the church and the state. Tsars for generations prior to St. Nicholas II had adopted the motto of orthodoxy, autocracy, and national character, or, I won't say it in Russian, to explain what defined Russia and what the Tsar as the father of the nation was fighting to protect. And in fact, the Tsar was often called the Little Father, and that's what Rasputin called him. This is not by being a smart aleck, this is the honor. St. Nicholas II worked with the church authorities such as St. John of Kronstadt, considered by many to be the holiest Orthodox Christian of Russia during the entire 20th century, to create an organization known as the Black Hundreds, funneling support from the church, money from the Tsar and other government sources, and the support of the Russian Orthodox patriots from every class. The Black Hundreds quickly grew in all areas of Russia and began producing multiple newspapers, social movements, and rallies filled with hundreds of thousands of enthusiastic and faithful citizens. Meetings and speeches were often held in Orthodox churches, either directly after service or during the week, almost always opening with a blessing performed by the local parish priest. Orthodoxy and Russian identity worked hand in hand to fight against the corrupting influences of Bolshevism, secularism, and the values of the French Revolution. The Black Hundreds were led by priests and bishops, with St. John of Kronstadt as the spiritual father of the entire organization. The goal of the Black Hundreds was to use the church and national politics to fight for a spiritual revival of traditional orthodoxy and to stand as a political bulwark against the forces of modernity, heresy, and Bolshevism. While working to increase the faith of the Russian people in orthodoxy, the Black Hundreds also focused on creating political movements to recruit candidates and bring the message of the movement to the masses. Fighting against the various democratic and communist movements, the Black Hundreds were willing to openly confront the enemies of the monarchy, the church, and the Russian people in the streets. In addition to this, the Black Hundreds, with the blessing of St. Nicholas II, that's the Tsar, and the spiritual leaders of the movement, put communist Jews into prison to prevent their seditious activities against the crown and the church. St. John of Kronstadt originally condemned the putting of Jews into prison until he found out that the violent anti-Christian activities and national subversion that the Jews were doing, which caused the need for their imprisonment. He later apologized for rushing to condemnation of the patriots for initially pushing some Jews in prison, and actively supported the movement until the time of his death. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the funny side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. I think I will come back to that. This is a very important and impressive essay, and I think very helpful in dealing with a problem that tends to bedevil Christians, and that is the siren song of universalism, and how this conflicts with protecting your race and your nation. According to this view, there should be no contradiction. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, Eastern time. I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever, played by the 48th Highlanders of Canada. Thank you.